Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to introduce Mark Rudd. He is the author of the book Underground, My Life with SDS and the Weathermen. Welcome, Mark Rudd, to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte, and thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure, and reading the book is a great pleasure. You grew up, let's just sort of start at the beginning. You grew up, in your own words, a kind of nerdy middle-class Jewish boy from the suburbs of New Jersey. You went to Columbia University in 1965, and you found yourself joining the protest movements there and quickly taking leadership. What were the issues that pulled you in?
Well, actually, it was the war in Vietnam and also the university's racist expansion. But let me just say, I didn't quickly take leadership. I spent 3 years as just a member of the SDS chapter, trying to organize, learning how to organize.
And what was that process like? Because, I mean, maybe I just read it quickly, but it seemed that it was such an amazing transition from you being a somewhat introspective person to being somebody who was standing in front of crowds, really getting people riled up.
I know. Even I was amazed by myself, actually. Well, it was a moment in history. I'm talking about the 3 years from 65 to 68, but it all kind of built to a crescendo in April of 68, in the spring of 1968. First of all, when I got to Columbia, I knew almost nothing at all about the war in Vietnam. I had just registered for the draft. I turned 18 in June. I didn't think anything of it. I went down and registered for the draft. All boys who turned 18 would register for the draft. I did it. However, I got to Columbia as a freshman, and I found there were all these really interesting people, really, you know, kind of vital, passionate, alive people who were organizing against the war, and I fell in with them. They became my crowd, you know, and I was kind of a loner in high school, and I kind of fell into this thing. And It was exciting. These people were talking as if they were going to transform the world.
And it was such an interesting moment in history because that feeling was very strong in the hearts of so many people that they really were going to transform the world. The cynicism that we saw later hadn't happened yet.
No. It was definitely a utopian moment. By moment, what I mean, a series of years. You know, first of all, It was a big shock to realize what our country was doing in Vietnam. I mean, we were murdering, later it came out, millions of people. And this put us, I mean, for a kid who grew up in the shadow of World War II, I mean, it was a major shock because the United States always fought for the right. I mean, we defeated fascism, and we know that that was the murder of millions. And then suddenly I wake up and I'm looking at this war in Vietnam and our country is doing this thing. Major shock.
This is a kind of an aside, but I thought it was a fascinating little story about how right at the beginning of freshman year you had the kind of identity crisis that a lot of people have, and you went to the school counselor and they put you in really old-fashioned, I guess that's what there was then, Freudian psychoanalysis.
Yeah, well, that's what was happening in New York, Freudian psychoanalysis. The drugs hadn't been invented,
right.
Antidepressants. But, that was the intellectual thing, and especially if you had money to do in New York at the time, go into psychoanalysis. And I found myself in psychoanalysis on the Upper East Side, and on alternate days I'd be tutoring a little boy in Harlem, And the whole cognitive dissonance of it, you know, the contradiction between me and the shrink and going to the shrink and then this world that was beginning to open up to me that I was starting to see. It was just too much. I finally said goodbye to the shrink, although he helped me later on by helping me get out of the draft.
That was the same shrink. Interesting.
Same shrink. And not only that, but he wrote a great book called Radical and Militant Youth. in which he analyzed the participants at Columbia. He was also the head of the counseling service at Columbia. He wrote a really good book. His name was Robert Liebert, and that book is still around. Well, that's my parrot. Do you hear my parrot?
Oh, indeed. That's great. So what were the actions that you and the people in SDS, Students for Democratic Society, did to draw attention to the war and issues of race and class and university policy?
Well, for the most part, it had to do with education. Teach-ins, showing films on Vietnam, discussions, what is Vietnam about, knocking on doors in dormitories, things that are kind of fundamental to organizing, you know, getting to know people and trying to get across some notion of what the war is about and how important it might be to each individual. I might add, Columbia being right smack up against Harlem, we were also very conscious of racism in society and the split between white and black. I mean, Columbia at that time was a mostly white university. So there was a lot of this educational work, but then there was also a growing sense of confrontation with the administration over issues like the university's participation in the war in the form of recruitment for the Marines or research. So over the course of those years, there was more and more confrontation, and it all came to a head, though, in the spring of 68.
You ended up in the midst of this giant occupation of many buildings in Columbia that was finally busted up by the police in a very violent way, and the purpose of it was in part to get Columbia to stop participating in this kind of secretive weapons research and development that they were part of a multi-university military consortium that you guys kind of pretty much discovered.
It had really been kept secret for the most part. That was one of the issues, yes.
So all of this great disruption and great learning and people getting hurt and people, you were finally expelled from school. Did it have any positive effect? In other words, did it accomplish anything toward the ends that you were seeking?
Oh, absolutely. I think Columbia was a great success from the point of view of the further radicalization of people. I mean, our goal as anti-war and anti-racism organizers was to grow the movement, to get more and more people involved. We started out as a fairly small core, maybe 75 people active, and by the time the dust settled months later, there were thousands of people who had become involved. So, no, Columbia became almost a model for militant student protest, and it was kind of a milestone in the development of the student anti-war movement and of SDS itself.
Did they withdraw from their participation in weapons research?
Actually, they did. But I'm sure it was only in some nominal way because there are other ways to hide it. All universities, research universities, get defense money. I mean, UNM does. It's just part of the deal. Some people have called it the military-industrial academic complex.
Right. We're talking to Mark Rudd, author of the book Underground, My Life with SDS and the Weathermen. So one thing that I found, there's many parts of this book that echo the kinds of protests and kinds of critiques of both the government and the media that we're involved in today. And one of them that I thought was so striking was how when the New York Times reported on what you were doing, they never actually talked about the reasons for the strike, the reasons for the occupations. They just talked about those radical students, look at them again, look at what they're doing, but never, why are they doing it?
Right. It's as if we had no demands, that our goal was disruption.
Right.
We were hooligans, according to their editorial page. And in the news pages, you'd never know that we had the actual demands that were relevant to anything. They also lied about the extent of the violence on the part of the police. And It was really eye-opening to a lot of us to realize that we were involved in this story that was reported so inaccurately.
Where were you getting your news at that time? I mean, from all the media critiques that we read today, there's kind of this sense that reporting, for example, about Vietnam was so much better than reporting about Iraq, which was really covered over. We never saw the blood and guts. Where were you finding out what was going on in the war? And
actually, most of our information came from the alternative press. There was a syndicate called Liberation News Service. In New York City, there was a so-called underground paper called The Rat. And these papers were all over. I think there were several hundreds of them. Here in New Mexico, there was one called Sears Catalog, S-E-E-R apostrophe S. They were everywhere in the country. Also, there were specialized leftist newspapers like the National Guardian, which came out weekly. We got a lot of information from writers like Wilfred Burchett, an Australian journalist who went to Vietnam and reported from the other side. It is true, though, that the regular press did have many more images of the war because they weren't controlled or embedded the way they are now. The reporters and photographers could roam. But generally speaking, the commentary and the editorial content tended to be quite pro-war. There's an interesting book on this subject by Todd Gitlin called The Whole World is Watching, in which, among other things he does, he takes up the question of what was the press biased against the war. And he finds that the New York Times and CBS had many times more experts commenting who were pro-war government officials rather than anti-war. So there was a myth that the mass media was against the war.
There's a split between liberals and radicals, which you describe in various places in the book. What was the nature of that division on campus in Columbia?
Well, at Columbia, it came down around how much we would keep to the central demands of stopping the university's participation in research and stopping its building of the gymnasium in Morningside Park, which became symbolic of the university's institutional racism. The liberals tended to want to substitute some kind of restructuring to increase student participation in formal disciplinary committees and things of this nature, whereas we wanted to keep that struggle going on about the university's support for the war and its institutional racism. So it came down around how much we held to these demands. Remember, liberal was a nasty word back then to most radicals, because we felt that the war in Vietnam was given to us by liberals like Kennedy and LBJ.
And so liberal connoted people who had sort of semi-good intentions but were basically going along with the government program.
Right, or compromising. And we wanted to push further. We wanted more radical demands. We were out for more radical demands, such as cutting off the research for the war. Liberals, it got to the point where the radicals kind of, we pushed ourselves out on the left limb, so to speak, during the presidential campaign of 1968, for example. A liberal position typically was to support an anti-war candidate like Eugene McCarthy or Robert Kennedy, and the radical position was the liberals gave us the war. We want a more fundamental transformation. The radicals tended towards being utopians.
And it's interesting because when you, again, looking at the similarities and differences between then and now, one thing that's so strikingly different is that you were involved in all of this as part of a collective, a large group of, you know, there were some differences, but essentially like-minded people who on occasion acted like a mob, but more often there was this sense of this large group being a source of inspiration, and you really had each other's backs, and you could count each other, and you were doing things together that none of you could accomplish by yourselves.
That's the essence of organizing, is bringing people together to get done what couldn't be accomplished alone. And we were organizing ourselves, and we were organizing the campus. However, later, that kind of turned into its opposite, and we became a kind of self-isolating group.
What was that? I mean, what was that like? And I guess I'm trying to imagine what we have today, if anything, that's comparable to that.
It's very cool. It's very cool to be with a bunch of people who are getting something done. Back in the 80s here in New Mexico, a number of us organized the New Mexico Construction Brigade to Nicaragua. And we built houses in Nicaragua. We found out about what was happening, how the United States was attacking the revolution in Nicaragua, and we came back and we organized opposition to American policy back here in New Mexico. We had maybe up to 100 people involved. It's very cool when you've got something, some good organizing going like that. It's kind of like a peak experience. Very wonderful.
Is there anything comparable to that you've experienced more recently?
Well, just today, for example, in my neighborhood, we're fighting in the South Valley in Albuquerque. We're fighting for a sector plan, a zoning sector plan, which will keep polluting industries out of our neighborhood. And today we had a defeat at the level of the County Planning Commission, but we still had 30 people who, from our neighborhood, who went up to talk to the county commissioner and gave them hell. And that felt wonderful, you know, even though we had a defeat, that the neighbors were getting together and were fighting. I mean, It goes back to an old tradition that I didn't even know about until I got to Columbia, which was the organizing of the labor movement and the civil rights movement, getting people together and going out and actually, you know, organizing a factory or getting people to stand up to vote in Mississippi. This is an organizing tradition that goes way back. I didn't know anything about it until I got to meet these kids who were doing it at Columbia.
We're talking to Mark Rudd, author of the book Underground, My Life with SDS and the Weathermen. So you were finally expelled from Columbia a year before graduation in 1968, and then you had a career going around to other college campuses and lecturing as part of SDS, and
career is a nice word. It was more like a thing I did. You know?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you were well paid, and you gave the money back to the organization, and you were really a kind of a rock star. Everybody knew who you were, standing ovations, and of course, every movement you did was also monitored by the FBI. How did your politics evolve once you left Columbia?
Well, I think we took the lesson of Columbia that militancy was going to gain support. And we overgeneralized that lesson. So part of what I was doing was I was going around telling the story of what happened at Columbia at various campuses, and I built up the idea of, in my own mind, of militancy as being the key to the victory, which was Columbia. Some people kind of took that up on various campuses, and we found that within SDS we were forming a faction. Which was based on the need for militant anti-imperialism, that we were not only against the war and racism, but we were against the system that gave us the war and racism. So we made, in a one-year period, we made a huge leap from being protesting against the war and racism to protesting the entire system behind it, which we called imperialism. I think that organizing that I did in that year set the stage for what was going to come the next year, which was the domination in SDS of this faction called Weathermen.
So the striking thing about this, you know, you said, okay, the militant thing worked. Then you have a kind of contradiction, which is militant anti-militarism, everything that's inherent in that phrase, and there was a kind of macho attitude that you had.
It was almost thuggery.
Yeah, it wasn't. Yeah, it was almost sort of embarrassing as somebody who reading it today, who's an ally of those ideas.
Imagine how embarrassing it would be for somebody to write that stuff.
Well, I know. I was thinking about that as I was reading it. What would you do differently now with the wisdom that you have looking over these decades?
It's a pretty complicated story. You know, it's hard to sort everything out, but we were kids, you know, and also there was a certain urgency and passion. We felt that the world was in revolution against U.S. domination and that we wanted to be a part of that. We didn't want to just stand on the sidelines and we didn't want to just cheer black people on in their revolt against racism, and we didn't want to cheer on the Vietnamese. We wanted to take some risks, too. So, I mean, we felt the world was involved in Revolutionary War, and we wanted to be a part of that. We even had a theory to justify it, which went back to Che Guevara. I mean, we had this whole intellectual framework, believe it or not. We weren't just completely crazy.
Right, and at the same time, the further out you got, the more you alienated, I'm not even centrist, but what you might call liberal or less out there allies that you might have had.
Absolutely. We even alienated the rest of SDS, because SDS might have had 100,000 active members, and we were at most 500. So, no, we were out on a limb, and we, in a way, our isolation proved how right we were, because we were the only ones who saw the truth. It's like any cult.
Right, right. Yeah, you say it. You actually were behaving in all the classic ways that a cult behaves.
Right, including internally all kinds of crazy practices like criticism, self-criticism, which we learned from books about China, and all kind of sexual and drug tests and all kinds of weird stuff. You know?
Yeah, I mean, the attempt to reform the nature of relationships between men and women by disallowing monogamy, that didn't work out so good.
No, that absolutely, that's an interesting story, but it didn't work out too well. What happened was women in the organization decided that in order for them to become full revolutionaries, they had to be independent of these male-female relationships that held them back. This wasn't a trick on the part of the male leadership. This was actually women who came up with this thing. So the line came from the women, smash monogamy, which would then mean that women would be free to be full collective members of the full members of the revolutionary collective that we were building. So, of course, it backfired, because what happened was it worked to the advantage of the male leaders, because it gave us more free women to sleep with. So, I mean, the whole thing was totally nuts.
So tell us how the group formed, the Weathermen. The name came from a Bob Dylan song.
Right. It came from a paper which our faction presented to the last national convention of SDS in July 1969. The idea of the paper was that revolution is already happening. It's happening in the Third World. It's happening here among the colonized non-white people, blacks, Latinos, and that you don't need Marxist dogma to see what's happening. You just have to look around you. So one guy, at the last minute, we didn't have a name for the paper. One guy, Terry Robbins, who later wound up dying in the townhouse a year later that exploded, he said, well, you don't need the Weathermen to know which way the wind blows. He was a big fan of Dylan's. He had a lot memorized, and it just came off the tip of his tongue. So that was the name of the paper. And clearly, since we had a great name like that, we became the Weathermen. And the leadership group became the Weather Bureau. So it all fit. But, of course, nobody knows what that means now. And it's not likely that Dylan ever knew what it meant. I don't think he was too happy about that, actually.
What do you mean?
Us using the phrase from Subterranean Homesick Blues as our title, and then taking the name Weathermen, and it somehow being derived from his line.
Right. So you and the Weathermen started going down a path that was increasingly sort of crazy and spinning out of control, and you could feel it, but you couldn't stop it. Tell us about that progression.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, you oftentimes what happened was we would say we were going to do something. Like in June of 1969, we decided we were going to have a militant demonstration in Chicago in October, which would coincide with the opening of the conspiracy trial. Abbie Hoffman, Tom Hayden, Jerry Rubin. That goes back to the Chicago 1968 demonstrations. So we said we're going to do this thing, and we're going to be militant, and we're going to fight the cops. So then we spend the next months organizing for it, and it doesn't quite come out the way we thought, but you can't stop. It's kind of, you say you're going to do something, so you got to do it, you know? And then after that defeat, very few people showed up. We actually had fewer people in October 69 than we had in June of 69. After that defeat, and hundreds got arrested and beat, and it was a real rout. We rationalized that and said, well, we have to, our line is right. We have to keep going with it. Militancy, building a fighting force, all this stuff. You know, we were kind of trapped by our own rhetoric. It was, a friend of mine calls it thinking yourself into a corner, and that's pretty much what happened. Then it even got worse when we decided to make the leap and build the underground.
There's a really poignant moment in the book where one of your friends comes back from having gone to Cuba and actually met Fidel Castro. And Fidel Castro looked kind of distracted. And finally, he said that Che Guevara had been killed, and somebody sent him from Bolivia a box with Che's hands in it. And he looks at the hands, realizes that they really are Che's hands because he recognizes them. And everybody just stops. And
it was kind of like the recognition of mortality right there. Of course, I got the story secondhand, and I retell it, you know, so...
Right, but you have, there's this beautiful line that you wrote in the book, and you said, finally, after all the public heroics and underneath the glory of Revolutionary the glory of Revolutionary War is human individual death. The meeting with Fidel was not what he had anticipated at all, and this understanding that it's all about human individual deaths really made you stop short. And then played out in a very painful way.
Unfortunately, it didn't make me stop short enough. I think that I was still into the heroics of it and still going on with it, or at least posturing at this revolutionary heroics. Yes, it was kind of like a foreshadowing of what I would realize much later. Just a few months after that, three of our own people wound up dead in New York.
So tell us that story.
Oh, the kind of rhetoric built about bringing the war home—that was part of the kind of out of control nature of things. Who knows what it meant, bringing the war home? You know, but our line was make Americans realize what we're doing in Vietnam. You know. That I guess that was the rationale for fighting cops, was bringing the war home. But then it also became the rationale for bombings. And there was a moment in March of 1970 when that thinking that we were the only ones who understood Vietnam and that we had to make it obvious to the country what we were doing there. We were killing so many people that we had to do something like it here. So that group based in New York, of which I was not a part, but I was aware of it, was planning a bombing of a non-commissioned officer's dance at Fort Dix. There would obviously be dates who were not military, and if the bombs had gone off, probably many innocent people would have died. That was probably the closest we came to a traditional definition of terrorism, which is attacking innocent people. Fortunately, those bombs went off prematurely, and we only killed three of our own people. But
it has really, kind of the feeling of
I'm sorry?
It has kind of the feeling of a Greek tragedy, the way it played
doesn't
out.
Doesn't it? It Yeah, tragedy is probably the only word I can think of it, describe it as. But however, it comes back later, even more tragedy, in the early 80s, when a remnant of the Weather Underground, joins with a black group that was robbing a Brinks truck, and three more people wind up dead, true innocents. No, there's a lot of tragedy involved in this. But anyway, it should have been a moment when we stopped and rethought everything. Instead, we did stop, but we rethought a few things, and one being that we would not attack people anymore. That was also the moment when I kind of dropped in the organization, and I no longer exerted leadership, and I kind of was demoted after that. By the end of 1970, I was officially out of the organization, but I was still a fugitive, and I remained a federal fugitive for 7.5 years.
Well, and that's an amazing thing. So there's a great moment where you realized that these guys that you saw that were in a restaurant that you were about to order a coffee at were dressed in tie-dyed jeans, and there was something that caught your eye that set off your suspicions.
They were brand new tie-dye jeans.
Yeah, they all had brand new tie-dye jeans, and something, a survival instinct inside of you said, hang on, and you got the hell out of it. And they were all federal agents, and if you had not thought fast, you would have been in jail.
Well, they chased me down 23rd Street in Manhattan, and I dunked into a subway, and then there was no train, so I had to come back up. I didn't want to be caught in a subway.
Right.
And I jumped onto a bus, and I lay down on the floor of the bus, which might have attracted a little attention on the bus, but I got away that way.
And that's what saved you. And then you went to the West Coast, and you eventually adopted new identities and lived with had two children with your college sweetheart. And you were in Santa Fe and all sorts of other places.
Santa Fe for 11 months, yeah. 71 to 72. Santa Fe was pretty important to me, I mean, in a lot of ways. One was I learned how to do construction labor, I realized that I was suited for that. And I began learning some trades in Santa Fe. And the other, which is probably more important, was that I fell in love with New Mexico. And Santa Fe was way too small. I got recognized about three times in a short few months there. And we had to leave, but that was in 72 when we left. But I always had it that in my head that I wanted to come back. I mean, the land, the people, the food, everything, the whole works, you know. I found I couldn't live without it.
There's one amusing incident that about Timothy Leary's jailbreak in which you were somewhat involved.
Yeah, I was involved in a support role, getting a truck ready, which would do the pickup, and getting an apartment ready in San Francisco. Actually, I did not meet Leary, and I wasn't involved in the actual jailbreak itself. But later on, after Leary was busted in 73, he ratted on all of us and even threw me into the pot, even though we hadn't met.
We're talking to Mark Rudd, author of the book Underground, My Life with SDS and the Weathermen. So when you were living essentially as a fugitive, you know, false identities, and you had it all worked out with all different sets of ID cards and your car not being tied to the place where you were living and so on. What was that like? I mean, it seems like life where you could never relax.
It was a lot of work, you know, and a lot of anxiety. A lot of labor went into building IDs and getting clean cars and car registrations and trying to figure out what was connected to what and keeping things straight and getting money. Just a lot of work went into it. After a few years of it, I felt, what the heck am I doing here? You know, what am I accomplishing other than not getting caught?
So during that time, did you reflect? Did you try to make sense of your time in SDS and the Weathermen?
Oh, yeah. I was always trying to figure out what I was involved in. It took a while, but I would say that toward around 74 or 75, I had a real break with the notion of armed struggle and guerrilla warfare. What really pushed me over the edge was the SLA, the Symbionese Liberation Army. And it made no sense to me, the kinds of things they were doing, holding up banks and spraying the bank with gunfire and just kidnapping Patty Hearst. And none of it made any sense whatsoever. And I started realizing that we were so far afield from where we had begun, which was organizing. Organizing on campuses, organizing actual people, which I was not doing. I was just being a fugitive. I was just trying to stay uncaught. Along about 74, 75, I realized that I was in the wrong place, for sure.
And so what happened then? How did you decide to end the fugitive life, turn yourself in, go on from there?
Well, one turning point was the actual end of the war in Vietnam in April of 1975. After the war was over, and there was a realization, too, that there wasn't going to be a revolution in this country, I decided that I needed to come up, that I needed to somehow figure out how to assume my real identity and to turn myself in. Some of it was facilitated by the fact that the big federal charges were dropped back in 73, actually at the beginning of Watergate, because of government illegalities. I write about this quite a bit in the book. The government had used all kinds of illegal means to get evidence against us. So a really good judge in Detroit dropped the charges. So the federal charges were finished. I didn't know if there would be new federal charges for bombings or for the townhouse explosion. But fortunately, a bunch of accidents made me wait until 1977 to turn myself in. And that was the first year of the Carter administration. It was post-Watergate, and the country was just tired of it all. Tired of the war, tired of Watergate, tired of the Republicans, just tired of the repression, tired of everything. And I it was a great moment. I just turned myself in and nothing happened. And I was free.
You did work with a lawyer at that time, and there are little passages of reflection all throughout the book of ways in which you used your privilege as a middle-class person who had the money to hire lawyers and who had the education to be able to, for example, get out of the draft, which you did, and to basically make a bargain whereby you would turn yourself in and not serve any time at all.
Well, that particular incident actually played in to a story that the media was putting out, which was basically that the era was over. If you're a contrite, middle-class white kid, you can come in and everything will be forgiven. So I actually played into that story. Had I been black, I probably would still be in prison right now for the stuff I was involved in.
Right. There's also a subtext throughout the book about your parents, whom you loved very much and who loved you very much and had given you everything that they had from their hearts and sent you to Columbia, and then you turned out to be a radical and a fugitive, and they would not
know. A bum. A communist.
Right.
The only thing worse would have been if I had been a homosexual.
Imagine that. And yeah, they would give you money thinking, well, at least he won't then deal drugs or get in worse trouble. And it's very poignant and very sweet, and they must have been so happy when you came out.
They were, but they were all they took their anger out, too. You know, it's kind of like your kid is almost killed and walking in front of traffic, and you grab the kid and shake him, you know. They were very angry, and, you know, it's 32 years later. Right now, my mother is in hospice, and she still throws those 7 years up to me. You know, my parents were very, very hurt by all of that. I think we treated them, I treated my parents monstrously. Imagine if my kids would do that to me.
We're talking to Mark Rudd, author of the book Underground, My Life with SDS and the Weathermen. So what made you decide to actually write this book now?
Well, I think the events of 2003 pushed me into it. Two things. One was the release of a movie. The first thing was the beginning of the war in Iraq in the spring of 2003. And I joined the anti-war movement, of course, and I thought, well, how, you know, what do I have anything that I can contribute that might be unique? And it was only in the summer of 2003 when the movie The Weather Underground, which I'll be showing on Friday night at El Museo, was released, that I realized that I had something to say. I had pretty well been hiding in Albuquerque. I mean, hiding in plain sight. But I was no longer Mark Rudd, the revolutionary bomb maker. I was a community college math instructor. And I had a different identity, which actually was a wonderful thing because I didn't have to go back. I didn't have to be this person in the past, but I could, and I could tell the story. So I had that confidence, but I really had not told the story because I was ashamed of so much of it. I mean, you know, you set out to do one thing and the opposite happens. So, but what I realized off of the movie was that young people were really wanting to know what it was about, The Weather Underground. You know, they were pretty well amazed that such a thing had happened. And I started speaking at college campuses. For example, I spoke twice at the College of Santa Fe to standing room audiences at the screen, and we had great discussions, Q&As after the movie, and I realized that I did have a lot to say and that people did want to hear the story. So I started in early 2004 writing, and it was a bit of a struggle to get it out right. It took me till the end of 2008 to actually have the manuscript finished.
I have to say I really enjoyed reading it a lot because you are honest about what happened, but you don't really seem to feel sorry for yourself. It's a pretty straightforward narrative.
If I did feel sorry for myself, I would be my own victim. You know, I think that one of the lessons that I take is it's the same as this bumper sticker I have on my car. It says, "Don't believe everything you think."
Right, exactly.
You know? It's the dangers of believing your ideas are right merely because they're your ideas. So, I wasn't sorry for myself. I just realized that I had dug myself into this hole. Also, that all of us were in a way victims of the war in Vietnam and of the passions that came out of it. I see myself as a kind of a Vietnam vet, although I don't get any VA benefits. I do have post-trauma stress disorder. I get really depressed every time the United States starts another war.
Right. Well, I was thinking, again, one of the differences between the Vietnam and the Iraq protests was that this time nobody was yelling, "Down with capitalism, down with imperialism," though there was lots of specific critique of profiteers like Blackwater and Halliburton and so on. What do you see when you talk to young people has changed and what has persisted in the way that people are protesting this ongoing war machine that our country still is?
Well, there's many differences, but addressing what you mentioned about nobody yelling down with the system, I think that there's been a real death of utopianism, of a sense that there is an alternative to this system. And 40 years ago, we still believed in socialism as an alternative, whatever that might mean. But now there are no obvious alternatives to capitalism. That doesn't mean that there aren't alternatives. It's just a failure of our imagination, I think. So this form of utopianism that we engage in is certainly out now, and I think probably young people are rightly look at the failures of the movement of the 60s and see that as a real negative. On the other hand, the strength of the 60s was we really did have a mass movement that really did stop the war and or help stop the war. And I think that the knowledge of that can happen, that mass movements actually can work, and the knowledge of how to build those movements has pretty well been lost. And so I'm hoping that, this story I tell can maybe point people in the right direction, because really it's a story of good organizing leading to Columbia, followed by terrible organizing, the Weathermen.
What's the best model that you've seen of a, I mean, the Weathermen, it went wrong, but it was a small group of true believers trying to accomplish something. What's a good model of a small group of believers who actually do accomplish something positive?
Well, in my lifetime, I think the labor movement, the civil rights movement, and the larger anti-war movement all were successful, and that they were all built using the same model, which is this model of one-on-one engagement between people, education, some degree of confrontation, and coalition building. You know, people who are or different kinds of people joining together for to achieve an end. The civil rights movement, for example, was a massive coalition of whites and blacks, church people and street people, middle class, working class. It was just labor. It was a grand coalition. And the best I can offer is that there's a lot to study of our history of the latter part of the 20th century. The women's movement, another mass movement that achieved great success. The gay movement, the disability rights movement, all of them. And they all use the same model, which I call the organizing model.
Mark Rudd is the author of the book Underground, My Life with SDS and the Weathermen. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's been a pleasure. Give it up!
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.